Amen. So it is June 15th, 2012. I am 4 days past my due date with our son, Landon. I was using the restroom in Target when my water broke, which was awesome and embarrassing and exhilarating all at the same time. And I called Neil, ecstatic that labor had finally started. He left work, we met at home, and we were driving to the hospital together. And my contractions were already only like a couple minutes apart. So we get to the hospital, and I'm already dilated to a 5. So they admit me to a room right away. I'm laboring, and Cindy Lindsay comes to the hospital to help me through contractions, help me labor. And she was there for a few minutes. And at the end of one contraction, I said, you know, I have to use the restroom. Should I go now or after the next contraction? And Cindy says, why don't you wait until after the next contraction? So not even a minute later, the next contraction hits me like I was being punched by a freight train. You guys know what I'm talking about if you're moms. And it was so intense and the pain was so harsh, I wanted to scream. But I remembered Sandy Foreman telling me, who has 7 of these people, little people, telling me years prior to let your labor noises be low and think low and open so the baby comes down and not high and tight and makes your body tense. So I am like trying to relax and I'm making low noises, and to my horror, pee all over the bed. And that's okay to say, right? We're all girls. So I'm gonna say pee. So I peed all over the bed and I couldn't stop because the contraction was so intense. So finally I'm able to like stop peeing and the contraction ends and I announce to everybody, I just peed all over the bed. And we all laughed, of course. And so I just thought, I'm gonna go finish in the restroom. So I got up and hobbled over to the bathroom and they changed the sheets. I barely made it to the toilet by the time the next contraction hit. And it did not feel like a baby was going to come out of me. It felt like 6 bowling balls were about to come out of me, and I let out a moan that was more like a roar. And the nurse and Cindy rushed in, they checked me, and the nurse said, oh, honey, you're at a 10, you're ready to push. And so I had gone from a 5 to a 10 in an hour, and I was in transition and those last few contractions. And so Neil's like in the other room, yay, cheering next to the bed that had the sheets changed. And Cindy said, okay, we gotta get you back to the bed. And I was like, nope. Walking is what I can't do right now. Walking over there is what I can't do. What I can do is have this baby right here in the toilet. You know those thoughts like go through your head? And I mustered out a little, I can't. And Cindy said, oh, yes, you can. And she grabbed one arm and the nurse grabbed the other arm. And we kind of hobble squat walked. I'm not going to do it. Hobble squat walked to the bed around the corner of the bathroom. And as we're rounding the corner, Cindy says to Neil, Neil, push the red button. And Neil's eyes got huge. He's like, where? He was looking for like a red button, like a my wife's ready to push kind of button. And no, it was a little, he found it. It was on the bed, just a little beep. And my doctor came rushing in, and minutes later, I was holding my little Landon in my arms. But transition, we know, is the most productive and intense phase of labor. Transition just plain hurts. It does. Thankfully, although it doesn't seem like it sometimes, transition is almost always the shortest phase of labor. It's during transition that many women want to say, I'm done. I don't want to do this anymore. I read in a book while pregnant that in labor, there is purpose to the pain. And I liked that because instead of trying to escape the pain, telling myself there was purpose to it was supposed to remind me that this pain was actually actively doing something, that there was an amazing reward that was gonna come out of this pain. I couldn't quit, I couldn't give up, I had to press on, I had to keep breathing. And I did tell that to myself during labor. There's purpose to this pain. Tonight, perhaps, you are going through a transition. The truth is, no one escapes transition. We're either going to be experiencing, recovering from, or about to face life-altering changes. If you live on planet Earth this last year, right, you guys have probably been shoved into some kind of transition or pushed into some kind of change, and for many of us, it hasn't been easy. As painful as it is to be stretched, both in labor and in life, transition is an essential aspect of giving birth to something new. And if you are in transition right now, you likely are experiencing some of that same frustration, impatience, and exhaustion and pain similar to transition in labor. Life's transitions can involve things like getting married, moving, finding a job, or a job change, or losing a job, finishing college, starting college, having children, health problems, miscarriage, the death of a loved one, getting a divorce, becoming an empty nester, retirement, just to name a few. But transitions can be very hard and very painful. And although transition is the shortest phase of labor, in life that isn't always the case, is it? It's during times of life transitions that so many of us feel like we want to say, I'm done. I can't do this anymore. It's too hard. It hurts too much. But the beauty of life's transitions is that we always have someone who can say to us, I know you can't, but I can, and I'll help you. Jesus is always with us, helping us, encouraging us, carrying us, and we'll talk more tonight about how he does that. But transition and the different dynamics that come with it are often unwelcome and unwanted, but God uses, this is our first PowerPoint, God uses change and challenge to bring about promotion and victory. It's essential to go through change and challenge in order to have promotion and victory. So tonight we're going to talk about going from trial to training to triumph in the during the transitions that life throws us. So trial, of course, is when the sudden change rears its ugly head at us. It's the hardest because it's the unexpected part. It's the shock value that delivers its first blow of pain and knocks us off course. The words, you're being let go. I don't love you anymore. Your test results came back. You need to come into the office. I'm leaving you. All without a moment's notice. Words like that catapult us into a trial phase of a transition. However, there are some transitions that completely skip the trial phase. Words like, or the trial phase lasts only for a very short time. So maybe words like, I'm pregnant. Maybe some of us had an unplanned or unwanted pregnancy, so there was a short trial phase, but I feel like for the majority of us, that's usually very small or not at all. Words like, you're being promoted. Will you marry me? You've been accepted. These kinds of transitions usually propel you straight to the training phase, and we'll get there in a little bit. But a great visual example of unexpected transitions in life is found in the concept of sailing. Neil and I have been sailing 2 times, and we were newlyweds in our young 20s, and a whole bunch of us friends rented a 50-foot sailboat that we were going to sail from the coast of Santa Barbara to the Channel Islands. And one guy, Taylor, who was our friend, knew what he was doing. He's the only one that had any kind of experience or sailing lessons, and the rest of us hadn't a clue. I had no idea of all the detail and skill and work that was involved in getting a sailboat to a destination without dying or getting incredibly lost at sea. It's not easy. So with sailing, you know, you use the wind to get you and your massive vessel to where you want to go. However, you'll learn right away in sailing that you have no control of the wind, none whatsoever. So in order to make progress, you need to know how to correctly position your boat and adjust your sails. So even if your destination is directly ahead of you, unless the wind is pushing you perfectly at your back, you're gonna have to take a not so direct route to get to where you wanna go. You're gonna have to make a series of alternating right angles and changes of direction numerous times to go in what is called a crosswise or a diagonal direction to the wind so that you can move forward. My friend and I would be on the front of the boat, and we'd be like, land ho, we see the Channel Islands. And all of a sudden, we'd be going this way. And we're like, And they looked like they knew what they were doing. Taylor was busy barking orders at the guys, and they're scrambling. And then a little bit later, the Channel Islands would be on that side of the boat. And that's how we got there. We did eventually go there. With sailing, of course. The moment of transition in sailing, when you bring your boat across the wind to make a 90-degree turn, is rarely a peaceful process. In order to catch the breeze, okay, that will propel you forward, you have to release the boom. Boom! That's why it's called that. And allow the wind to whip the sail across the vessel. Now, this can be terrifying. If you're not on alert and paying attention, you could be knocked overboard. In fact, one of the guys that we were with decided it would be fun to like sit on the boom and ride on it. And yes, he was thrown several feet when it jerked to a stop. He was okay. But similarly, life can seem frustrating when we see our goal or our destination, whether it be a dream job or getting married or graduating. But unexpected changes and transitions hit us dead on, and it seems like the winds of life are actually pushing against us, making it difficult to make progress. God's closed doors may feel more like rejection than protection, don't they, sometimes? Because we don't have a bird's eye view while sailing, we can't actually see that we are making progress. Inside a rocking boat being tossed about by winds you can't control may feel like you're actually aimlessly heading nowhere, but the truth is you rarely get from A to B in sailing in a straight line. From God's perspective, though, our seemingly chaotic route can actually look like an intentional design from start to finish, although it may be more of a scenic route than a direct one. And in life, while we're going on a longer, more educational route to get to where we want to go, we learn a great deal in the process that benefits us from then on. When our lives start going crosswise, we must keep our eyes on our North Star, on Jesus. You always know where the North Star is in the sky. So long before GPS units and satellites were around, sailors would use the North Star for direction. No matter where you are in the northern hemisphere, you know you're facing north if you're looking at the North Star. Jesus is our North Star, our ultimate goal, to give us a point of direction and guide us through a difficult journey. So as we navigate stormy seas and changing tides and unpredictable winds, we can cling to God's promise in Isaiah 43:2 that says, when, not if, when you go through deep waters, I will be with you. That is a promise. And some of us have been through some very deep waters and some very rough seas. And the trial that came with our transition was far from short, and the pain was anything but mild. I truly understand what it's like to be sailing through life that had its fair shares of storms and challenges, but none that left you feeling like you're drowning in pain so harsh that it literally fills your lungs and it hurts to breathe. I've never had to face a transition or a trial before like we had to when our baby Ryden was born. Once he was on life support after being born dead, the doctors told us that he would have severe cerebral palsy, little to no muscle control, and would likely never be able to even recognize people. When we got to Ryden for the first time in the NICU, after a doctor gave us a horrific diagnosis, I looked at him and I was crying, and I asked him, "What can I do?" That's what I said, "What can I do?" And he looked at me straight-faced, and he said, "Don't pain yourself with pumping." So I went home and I pumped every 2 hours around the clock, day and night, for months and months and months until there was not one drop left in me, and Ryden eventually got every ounce of it. But that's how convinced they were that he was gonna die. Don't even pain yourself with giving him the best. So I know what it's like to be okay 1 minute and then the next minute be thrown so far off course that you're suffering, and you know you will survive, you just don't know how. Our trial was quite long. The first year was especially hard and painful because we were set with constant decisions, hard decisions and setbacks and more trials, but yet, you guys, my family somehow found and chose joy. And we really were given a supernatural strength and a grace. It was not me, it was not us. And we really did have a peace that surpassed all understanding as long as we kept our eyes on Jesus. As soon as we looked at the storm and we looked at how big the waves were and how terrible the storm could get and how overwhelming it could be, then we started to get lost at sea. Then we started to be overwhelmed by the storm. But as long as we kept our eyes on Jesus, we did not sink, and we did not sink. There were times in my grieving that I would remind or ask myself, there is purpose to this pain. Is there purpose to this pain? He prunes nothing from our lives without purpose. And pruning can be quite painful, but there is purpose to this pain, which brings us to our next phase of transition, which is the training phase. The first time we went sailing, we went with no training at all. We had no idea what we were doing. Taylor was the only one that knew what was supposed to happen, and he was the only one, and there was like 12 of us that had no clue, and half of us were girls, and we were like, book, bow, boat, sunshine, bye-bye, and that's what we were doing the whole time. So Taylor had his work cut out for him, trying to get the guys to do what they needed to do. The second time we went sailing, Taylor took the following year, he took us in a room off the dock with a whiteboard and a dry erase marker, and he gave us a class, like a short training on what we needed to know and how we needed to work together and what we needed to do to sail. So winds like starboard and port and tacking and helm and windward and leeward, we now understood. We had been trained. The training was needed. It was necessary. Gail Bones, the author of this book, Living Crosswise, took up sailing lessons as a hobby when she was let go of her dream job. So during the difficult transition of being fired, she took up sailing lessons and it made some beautiful discoveries about the correlation between life and sailing. This book is actually where we derived the theme for our retreat from. So in searching for more meaning behind the term crosswise, which is to be diagonal to the wind, she discovered one of the definitions of the word crosswise in the dictionary was actually in the form or in the shape of a cross. So she created the living crosswise concept where you stand in the shape of a cross with your head pointing up, your feet pointing down, and your arms extended out, symbolizing that living crosswise during transition means that you're looking up to God for help and through prayer. You're looking down at where you stand and what you stand for and inward at who you are. So this is self-examination. You reach outward toward those that have gone before you and outward toward those who are coming behind you. This is a picture of a biblical way to go through transition. This is a great visual model. See, too often, too many of us get stuck at the trial phase. We wallow in our pain. We isolate. We put off making decisions. Fear paralyzes us into darkness, into the darkness of pity and even self-destruction. Now, there is absolutely a place and a need for grieving that must be done in its full course, and no one gets to rush that. That is absolutely true. And grief may come and go throughout your transition process, and that's okay. But the truth is that there is purpose to the pain if we don't stay there in the trial and we let it train us. Now, this training we can call the school of humility, because it takes humility to recognize that we've been knocked off course by transition and to let it teach us something. But in order to do that, we must bring our pain and our trial to the cross, to the shape of the cross. So the first place we're going to look is to God. We go to God first for help and through prayer. Not to Google, not, right? Siri don't know it all. And not doctors, not friends or family, but first we go to God. Matthew 11:28 is the verse where Jesus says, "Come to me, all who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest." He's the only one that can do that. True rest can be near impossible to experience when you're going through a trial or through a difficult transition. There were so many times in my bedroom or in my kitchen or in Ryden's hospital room when we were rocking him during what we thought were his last breaths, when agony and unrest would return. And sometimes all I could muster out was Jesus. And the Holy Spirit would come over me in such power that I would crumble to the floor in tears of relief. His rest was literally tangible. I could feel his presence penetrate my physical body and turn my pain into peace. He did that. However, the rest that he offers wasn't always immediate. It wasn't. Often I had to seek it out and choose to accept the truth, even if my flesh didn't want to believe it. It's easy to doubt in the dark what we once believed in the light, right? When familiarity is gone, it can become difficult to hear the voice of God, even though that's when we need to hear him the most. Sometimes that's all we need, huh? Is just to say, God, what do you have to say about this? What do you have to say about all this? Sometimes God did seem more silent to me until I picked this up. This is his voice. His voice is here. He was here. I couldn't go a day in my suffering, hours. I couldn't go hours sometimes without reading his words, without listening to his voice. This book is an anchor that keeps us from wandering away from the truth, especially and even in the dark. I would drown without hearing his voice. I would sink. Neil and I had verses taped on our bathroom mirrors above our bathroom sinks because we needed it. We needed to constantly hear his voice and read his words. We needed it to drown out the temptation of hopelessness and fear and despair. So in looking in this position, we are crying out to God. We're telling him our frustrations. We're seeking his voice and his truth and looking to him for answers. Another way many look to God through prayer is by journaling. My entire life up until 12 years ago is in journals. It was very beautiful for me. It was a safe way for me to formulate my thoughts, express my feelings, organize all my uncertain emotions into a 3-page prayer. I would write scriptures in prayer form. And many storms I encountered as a younger person were processed and expressed in journals. And it was very freeing to me because it all wasn't in here anymore. It was there. And it just was very helpful to me. So if you feel like that would be meaningful to you, I encourage you to use that as a means to talk to God. So after we've looked up to God, we're going to look down at where we stand and inward for self-reflection, okay? Psalm 139, verses 23 and 24 say, this should be our prayer, search me and know my heart. Put me to the test and see if there is, and know my anxious thoughts and see if there is any hurtful way in me. So our next position is asking questions about where we stand. What do we stand for? So questions like, am I planted on a firm foundation? What grounds have I been basing my most recent decisions off of? Have they been made from anxiety or doubt or fear? Has my way been hurtful? Has my way been hurtful? It says, see if there's any hurtful way. Has my way been hurtful to me or to others? A great prayer is, have I sinned, Lord? Show me my sin, Lord. Could I be the reason my life seems so off course? The last part of verse 24 says, lead me in the everlasting way. Neil and I pray often that our kids would place the most value on eternal things, everlasting things. We try to train them to see the most important things as the things they cannot see. So things like the fruits of the Spirit, giving with expecting nothing in return, selflessness, honoring authority, praying for those who hurt you, loving your enemies, as opposed to putting value on what the world offers them, things that they can see, like wealth or material possessions or outward appearance or popularity. So a good question to ask when we're looking inward is, what kinds of things do I put the most value on? What can I change, Lord, to make my way match your way? A prayer I've prayed often is, Lord, change my desires so that I want what you want for me. What good disciplines have started to take the back seat in my life and been replaced with less valuable ones? Let's ask the question, who am I? Who am I really? I love 1 Peter 2:9. It says, you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, so that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who has called you out of darkness and into his marvelous light. Peter wrote this to Christians scattered all throughout Asia Minor who were suffering and enduring hardships. They were going through trials and transitions. And Peter's saying, I know it's hard, but remember who you are. Remember whose you are. You are chosen. The royal priesthood part is referring to how priests used to be the only ones that could offer sacrifices acceptable to God. But through Jesus, now we have complete and full access to the Father. He accepts us. So Peter's saying, you are a holy people, a holy nation, because God chose you as his own so that you could tell the world about how awesome he is and what he's done for you and how he saved you. So what I'd like to do is to get that verse up there again, 1 Peter 2:9. I would like to ask that we say this verse together, but instead of it being in the third person, I'd like to say it in the first person. So instead of you, we're gonna say I, and instead of people or person, we're gonna say woman. okay? There's something profound and powerful about speaking and proclaiming truth. So we're gonna do that tonight. Are you ready? 1 Peter 2:9. I am a chosen woman, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a woman for God's own possession, so that I may proclaim the excellencies of him who has called me out of darkness and into his marvelous light. Amen. You are a chosen daughter of the King of the universe with a royal inheritance on a special mission, and no one and nothing can take that away from you. 1 Corinthians 16:19 and 20 says, did you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit within you, whom you have from God, and that you are not your own? For you have been bought with a price. Therefore, glorify God in your body. So a good question to ask is, Lord, when we're looking inward, Lord, how have I used my body, a temple of your Holy Spirit, to be distinct from the world? How am I using this body that I only get one time to proclaim the excellencies of you who has saved me? Another good thing to pray after we've asked all these questions is, forgive me. And his response, already have. So his forgiveness and his freedom is available to all of us. The price has already been paid. What a price it was. So after we're looking inward for self-evaluation, self-reflection, and downward at where we stand and what we stand for, we're gonna look outward. We're gonna look out to those that have gone before us and out to those that are coming behind us. I was 18 years old, newly attending Mike Van Meter's home group. I had been to Foothills probably 3 or 4 years, and Neil and I were dating, and Mike had Hank and Vicky Demahusky come be guest speakers at his home group. And one of the things that Hank said that night, I never forgot, because it was a foreign concept to me at that point. One of his points was to be cross-generational, and explaining that it is best to have relationships with people, close relationships with people much older than you and much younger than you. And I remember thinking when he said that, oops, because I really love the Lord. I wanted to grow in my relationship with him, but up until this point, this was a very undesirable concept to me. I had this underlying agreement with myself that close relationships were to be with people my own age. I didn't have any desire to share my life with people older than me or with people younger than me. Even with my friends growing up, I would try to not make eye contact with their parents. I would never initiate, I would never initiate conversation. I would really try to not engage in conversation. I just didn't care. And even with my friends' younger siblings, they were all bothersome to me. I was not interested in playing with them. My school teachers were for school only. I didn't talk to them before or after class. No desire. I was in high school when the first Future Quest happened, and I remember when they told us that junior highers were going to be allowed to come to Future Quest, and we were disgusted. Junior highers at Future, not junior highers are loud and annoying and immature and icky. And the only ministry that I had been involved with at that time was my high school small group, which were girls my own age. And I did a sunshine club, which was mostly first and second graders. But even then, I didn't play with the girls. I was there to do my object lesson and my part of the Bible study. And when it was over, I was very quick to leave. I was done. So based off of Hank's words, I decided to experiment with being cross-generational. I asked Monica Hunter to mentor me. We didn't even know each other. I don't even think we had spoken to each other. And her response was so gracious. She said, well, let me pray about it. And on our first meeting, she said, so why do you want to be mentored by me, and how often would you like to do this? So we met every other Saturday morning for breakfast with no agenda other than to talk and laugh and cry and pray. She asked me questions. She listened. I learned to ask her questions, and I listened. She held me accountable to the boundaries that Neil and I had on our relationship. She graciously corrected me when I was wrong and needed correcting. She challenged me to become and achieve all that God had for me. I saw in her what I dared to believe was possible in a Christian woman. I saw it. And she later was the matron of honor in our wedding. And I still, even today, I still remember concepts or ideas or things that she taught me that I now teach and model to my kids. So her influence over my life really has a ripple effect that is eternal. So about a year into Monica and I meeting, she and I and two other leaders, one of my best friends and another mom, were going to do a sixth grade girls junior high group. I was gonna do it. And Monica explains to me, hey, since we've been meeting for a year now for breakfast and we're gonna be seeing each other every Friday night, let's stop meeting on Saturday mornings. And I remember like starting to have a 19-year-old heart attack. And I was like, okay, if you say so. And lo and behold, not even a week later, a girl a few years younger than me asked me to mentor her. And this had never happened to me before. So I told her, I will pray about it. And on our on our first meeting, I said, so why do you want to be mentored by me? And how often would you like to do this? I knew what to do. So I started a junior high girls, junior high group. I started a higher ground club. I picked up a youth venture shift. I started teaching second service junior high Sunday school with Neil and Mike on Sunday mornings. I poured my heart and my soul into these junior hires that I once despised, and I fell in love with them. I started a mentor group called Sisters Group that met every Monday night because so many of these little junior high girls wanted me to mentor them, but I couldn't individually anymore, so I created a mentor group, and we met every Monday night, and I mentored them that way. I spent as much time as I could with a lot of these girls outside of the actual ministry that I was in with them. I loved them. I loved them. I picked them up from school. I took them shopping. I bought them Slurpees. I went broke on them. I gave them rides, you know? And if I wasn't at work or sleeping, I usually was at church just about every day of the week or doing some kind of ministry, reaching to and connecting with and serving the generation under me. I started purposely putting myself in and around the council of women like Sandy Foreman, Linda Hoffman, Marilyn Goodman, Kathy Martin, Sandy Zolman, Tammy Steckler, Allison Bennett, Mary Hoffman, Lexi Ebert. There's so many, and that's just a few. I literally went from not even making eye contact with the generations before me or under me and trying to avoid conversations with them to literally saturating my life with them. Living cross-generational really was so beneficial and enriching and beautiful for all of us. The biblical model is to mentor and be mentored. That's what we should do. This is critical, especially when going through a transition. We must reach outward if we're going through something different or a trial. While Ryden was in the NICU, even in the months that followed while he was on hospice care, anytime we reached out with a need, we were met with an overwhelming response from both young and old to the point where we had to like turn help and support away because there was so much. We're like, we're okay now, we're good. There were needs filled that we didn't even know we had. Everything, before we even knew how to ask for needs, they were met. Grocery runs, meals delivered, gifts and toys given to our other kids, free babysitting, gift cards, gift baskets. We'd come home from the hospital and there's stuff at our doorstep almost every day. The generations before us, particularly, really did reach behind them and carry us and help pull us through this critical, trying time. And they bore our burden on their shoulders. And it really did make it lighter for us. But even in non-traumatic experiences, Foothills as a whole was incredible at reaching out to me when I was in high school and college. I wasn't shunned because I was young and energetic. There might have been those that were like, you're a little hyper for me. And I get that. I was a little hyper. But for the most part, the majority really did. I felt loved and accepted and wanted in my youth. And that may not be the case for everyone. Our church is much bigger now than it was 20 years ago when I was in high school. But if you are a younger woman in here, and perhaps you don't feel the same way I did, maybe you don't feel accepted or wanted by the generations before you, may I just challenge you to make sure that you are inviting and playing a part in initiating cross-generational relationships. When I wasn't seeking for relationships with older women, I didn't have them. I asked Monica to mentor me. It wouldn't have happened otherwise. I had to be purposeful and intentional to get to know women and younger girls. It was difficult for me to even ask Monica questions because up to that point, I just didn't care what other women had to say. And of course, it goes both ways, right? Women in your 40s and 50s and 60s and so on, God bless you for being here. Speaking from experience, those of us in our 20s and 30s, I'm still there, in 30s, we still want your wisdom and your hugs and your drive-by compliments. Those are my favorite. I just got one out there. Thank you. But some of those are remembered for years. Just a drive-by compliment. You're so beautiful, or God bless you for something, something. Those matter to us. They really do. And yes, we need your prayers. And to, if it works out, have coffee or tea with you. But let's make sure that we're reaching out to each other. This is not a cross, right? We want to live crosswise in the shape of a cross, reaching out to each other. Lastly, with Jesus, we can always expect our transitions to lead us to triumph. That usually doesn't mean easy. It doesn't even mean that things will end up our way or the way that we hoped that they'd end. It means we have victory. It means we didn't lose. There is no losing when you're on the winning team, right? So when our enemy throws us crosswinds or storms, victory means that he lost if we keep going in the right direction towards our North Star. That is victory. My little Ryden still has cerebral palsy at 6 years old, but he is living life and loving life like no medical professional would have ever dared to believe that he would when he was first born and diagnosed. His life is smothered with miracles and healing and victory and wholeness. Ryden smiles and laughs and crawls and rolls, and he sits up and he's learning to steer and maneuver his own wheelchair. When you hold his hands, he'll walk towards you, and he communicates using an iPad. He talks with an iPad, and he tells us what he wants and what he doesn't want. He loves trampolines and swimming pools. He has a favorite food and a favorite book and favorite toys and a favorite brother. Don't tell him I said that. But it's rarely easy. It's rarely easy. We believe Ryden is healed. Now, we'll continue to pray for more healing until the day we die, but Ryden's life is a victory now. I don't see Ryden as crippled. I see Ryden as created. I don't see Ryden as damaged. I see him as destined. And I've learned that a big portion of getting to triumph is simply perspective. Can you show that painting up there? This is a painting it's in Neil's office right now. When Neil saw this painting during the hardest part of our trial, the thing that his eyes went to first was the sun. This is clearly after a massive storm. The sails are weathered, but the sun is coming. And it gave Neil immense hope. The sun always comes out after a storm. Maybe we need to focus less on the storm, the aftermath of the storm, the hardships the storm caused, and focus more on the sun. My family and I live in victory because we've decided to still go this way. It doesn't have to be complicated. It is that simple. It's not easy. Simple and easy are different, but that is victory. And victory can look different for all of us, but you cannot have true lasting victory unless you are looking and living that way. That's where victory is. There will always be storms. We're always going to face them. We'll never go without facing them. And there are times that Jesus does say to the wind and the waves, "Peace, be still," and the storm stops. But not usually. Usually, we need to go through the school of humility. We need to be trained first before we're promoted. We must go through transition before the birth of something new. If we make sure we get our lives focused on our North Star, if we live crosswise and look in all the right places when things get rough, if we remember there is purpose to this pain and we let it teach us and train us and learn from our mistakes and life experiences, then we will encounter victory and have triumph. So where are you tonight? Maybe some of you are in deep waters, and you've been there a long time, at a start of a transition or in a trial. Maybe some of us are in the school of humility, and we're still being trained, and you want to start living crosswise and be more intentional about being cross-generational. Band, you can come up here. Well, we want to pray for you tonight. So my question, as the band comes up, is where do you need to look more? This is the biblical model for how to go through transition. We've all been through transition recently. Probably you're going through one now. Where do you need to look more? Do you need to look up more, downward or inward more? Which way should you look out more? Let me pray for you. Lord, I thank you that you always have a purpose to our pain. Lord, that you are so intentional and so comforting and gentle with us. Lord, I thank you that you've given us such a beautiful church with older women and younger women, and that you want to speak to us and to love us and to teach us and to comfort us through one another. So we invite you, Lord, to come and prick our hearts, that you would give us a sense of urgency, that we would know how can we better be your hands and your feet to the generations before us and the generations under us. We love you, Lord. We need you, God. Help us to ask the right questions about ourselves. Come, Holy Spirit.